meet here to nominate the next President of the United States.
Mr. Chairman.
What's going to happen at Miami Beach? Brought to you by Vote Toothpaste, the dragon killer that cleans and whitens your teeth while it kills the dragon in your mouth. Here now in our convention hall anchor booth is Walter Cronkite.
Good evening from Convention Hall in Miami Beach on the eve of the 1968 Republican National Convention. What's going to happen in Miami Beach is, of course, the Republican delegates representing the Republican Party rank and file will choose a presidential candidate and adopt a party platform of attitudes toward important matters of national policy. What we are going to see and hear tonight are some of the acts, the actors, and their thoughts as they go about making that choice. That big decision is the cumulative result of many individual choices, of course. And the question whether it is going to be Richard Nixon or Nelson Rockefeller or Ronald Reagan or someone else is usually hammered out at a peculiar episode called a caucus, which is a meeting usually closed to outsiders of individual state delegations. One of those meetings is going on right now at the Delito Hotel at Lincoln Road in Miami Beach, where the Alabama delegation is in caucus, and Nelson Benton stands ready to report. Nelson?
Walter, there are a couple of things unique about this Alabama caucus. For one thing, the lobby is full of people because this is not just a caucus of the Alabama delegation. It's expecting a visit from California Governor Reagan, a visit that the California governor himself requested. The Alabama delegation is at this point believed to be about evenly split between Nixon and Reagan. There's not believed to be a Rockefeller vote in the House. And so Reagan is coming by to pay his respects to Alabama and its votes. It's so secure here with the Secret Service. In fact, I saw one security man stop another one a little while ago. Also involved here is the question of whether Alabama will yield its first place in the balloting to California to nominate Reagan or to another undisclosed delegation to nominate Mr. Nixon. They've been gently approached by representatives of both candidates. One member of the delegation told me that Alabama feels that every now and then people malign them, and so they sort of like this being wooed by the delegates, and they know it won't last too long after the convention. Nelson Benton, CBS News, with the Alabama delegation.
The bulk of the activity for the next 4 days will be directed from the rostrum out there in the convention hall. During the convention, Harry Reasoner is going to be reporting from out there. And earlier today, he was on the rostrum talking with the convention's permanent chairman, Congressman Jerry Ford of Michigan.
Mr. Chairman, the man in your job used to be very powerful at a convention. He could really control events. Has the era of television and publicity changed that? Are you just a figurehead now, sir?
Well, I hope not, Harry. I really don't think that the chairman is a figurehead, although certainly the exposure given to the platform and the people on the platform by television has made them more careful in how they rule and what they decide. But the powers of the chairman are still very, very influential in how the convention proceeds, how well we do in the public eye. As you do know, the convention chairman, with the rap of a gavel, can make a decision that will involve what amendments are called up first, or whether a person has gone too long in his presentation. And of course, the chairman, by the power of recognition, as he looks out over this audience here, and he sees the delegations from the 50 states and the three other areas, he can recognize the individual that he wants. And the person who gets the platform first very, very often can have a great advantage.
It's quite a hall to keep track of. I see it's a one-story color-coded hall this year. Does that mean a one-story kind of convention?
I hope not, Harry. And my best judgment at this stage of the ballgame is that we're going to have a very lively convention, and I don't think the decision is one that's already made before the convention actually gets started.
With your power looking out there and recognizing one person rather than another, can you stay neutral for the next 4 days?
Well, Harry, I better, or I'll get thrown off the platform. But I've tried to be very neutral, impartial so far, and no one's tried to embarrass me. And I think I can be fair and impartial in selecting people for any of the motions they make or any of the other decisions that are important.
You'd range yourself, Mr. Chairman, on the side then that anything can happen, that you don't think the events of the next 3 days are all laid out yet?
I really don't, although, of course, the Nixon people are talking very confidently and the Rockefeller and Reagan people are very encouraged. I think all of this means that when the nominations are made and the votes are cast, there will be a lot of tension, a lot of excitement, and I think this is good in American politics.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Ethel, I think there's a dragon in my mouth.
Let's see.
Yeah?
Yes, there is. Oh, what you need is vote toothpaste, Marvin. It's for adults who eat and smoke, you know, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Vote has a strong, fresh taste. And it cleans and brightens.
Oh, did I hurt you, dear?
No, it's just so refreshing, Ethel.
You're feeling the dragon being slain.
Dragons are funny.
Not from my side, Marvin.
Vote the dragon killer.
Who says men don't care about their hair? You care about your hair, so don't smear grease on it. Spread Vitalis through it. Vitalis has no grease, and Vitalis spreads to keep your hair looking fresh and clean, not stiff or sticky. Vitalis has no grease.
The name of the game here is, of course, delegates and how they will cast their ballots for the presidential nomination on Wednesday night. The count right now is so close, and we'll report it to you a little later in this broadcast, that the decision may rest on one or more of three delegations that have been pledged to their favorite son governors, those of Maryland, Ohio, and Michigan. But tonight came definite word that Richard Nixon has engineered a major breakthrough in that phalanx. Mike Wallace has learned that Maryland's Governor Spiro Agnew tomorrow night will announce he backs Nixon. But more than that, he will also make the nominating speech for Nixon on Wednesday night. And he'll take with him as many as 16 of Maryland's formerly uncommitted votes. Mike will be out on the convention floor all next week. This week, that is, but for the past year or so, he's been reporting on the Nixon candidacy. Tonight, he's at the Nixon headquarters at the Hilton Plaza Hotel.
Everybody who is anybody in the GOP is here in Miami Beach, except for Richard Nixon, and he's due in tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. His staff has been quartered in the top three floors in the penthouse of the Hilton Plaza for the last 10 days, and everyone acknowledges they are running the most meticulous operation of all. Nothing is overlooked. But most of their attention currently is being lavished on the care and cultivation of the delegates. Roving Nixon bands, given some competition by Rockefeller boosters, work the airport, greeting delegates as they step off their planes. And back at Nixon headquarters, a fleet of cars, courtesy cars for delegates, move out of the parking lot all day long. Nixon's Navy, a fleet of private boats, cruises the waters, offering rides to delegates. The message every place is that Nixon is the one. By way of stunning contrast, 1,500 miles from the sound and fury of Miami Beach, Richard Nixon himself has spent the last 4 days in this five-room cottage, perched on a wooded hill overlooking the Atlantic at Montauk on Long Island. 8 to 12 hours each day, this man with a prodigious appetite for work has been writing his acceptance speech and thinking about the issues in the campaign that he is confident lies ahead. He says it is the last interval he'll have for solitude and quiet thought before that rigorous campaign. I flew up to Montauk to talk with him today.
Mr. Nixon, do you expect a first ballot victory?
I think there is a good chance that we could win in the first ballot, but I'm not predicting it. My managers all believe we're going to win in the first ballot, but I just say we're going to win. I know anything can happen at a convention.
Well, you've said for the past 6 months that Ronald Reagan and not Nelson Rockefeller would be your chief rival for the nomination. Why?
I think the events of the past week or so indicate the validity of that statement. Apparently, the gains that have been claimed by the Rockefeller forces have not been for Governor Rockefeller, but for Ronald Reagan. But on that point, I simply will defer any other comment. I think I'm going to win. I think both Governor Rockefeller, Governor Reagan, their forces have put on very strong campaigns. And if we win, I know they're going to be just as strong working for our victory in November.
Three of the favorite sons major states, Rhodes of Ohio, Romney of Michigan, Agnew of Maryland, are said to hold the key to the nomination. Do you agree?
They could. If one or two or three of them move, it will make our chances overwhelming on the first ballot. If all of them hold, it will mean that the chances of a first ballot victory are still good, but not as overwhelming.
Do you think it's possible for you to get a first ballot nomination without the help of Rhodes, Romney, and Agnew?
I'm not going to make a prediction on that. Again, my optimistic managers, and managers are always optimistic, that's their business, they believe that it's possible. But we're taking nothing for granted. We want the support of Rhodes and Romney and Agnew and everybody that we can get, and we want them to know that we need their support and that we're not taking it for granted that we can win without them.
I suppose that you have special regard for the vice presidency, having been one, and there have been various statements made about the way in which you are choosing your vice presidential running mate. Would you elaborate?
Mike, I have left that decision open, and I'm being completely honest with you when I say that. I have left it open until after the nomination because I want to give all of the leaders of the party a chance to have their say as to who would make the best president and who would make the best campaigner as the vice presidential nominee. That decision will be made on Thursday morning after the nomination Wednesday night.
If Richard Nixon isn't very confident about the outcome here in Miami Beach, he is an exceedingly good actor. He's been receiving telephone briefings about how the delegate count is going before he goes to sleep each night up in Montauk, Long Island, and he has the look of a man who has been sleeping very well. There has been slippage in the Nixon first ballot figures. 2 weeks ago, his aides were confident of 740 delegates on the first go-around by the time the switches had been made. Tonight, they acknowledge that figure has slipped to just over 700, with most of the difference going to Ronald Reagan. But Nixon needs only 667 for the nomination. And unless the Reagan people are masking a big surprise, unless they have a good many delegates playing possum about their intentions, the Nixon people feel that there is little reason to believe this convention will go past the first ballot to nominate their man. Mike Wallace, CBS News, at Nixon headquarters in Miami Beach.
Nelson Rockefeller, the last of the major candidates to enter the race for the Republican nomination, that was just 100 days ago, was the first to arrive for this stretch drive here in Miami Beach. His headquarters, the Americana Hotel, was also the furthest from Convention Hall, northernmost of the convention hotels. Mort Dean is there.
3 months ago, Nelson Rockefeller entered this contest as an underdog and an optimist. Now, after traveling 65,000 miles, visiting 45 states, and spending millions of dollars, he remains an underdog, but is more of an optimist. Completely unimpressed, he says publicly and privately, by those who argue that Richard Nixon will leave Miami Beach as the Republican nominee. During his travels today, he visited the friendly New York delegation and the not-too-friendly Illinois group. The candidate claimed he had made gains since his arrival in Miami Beach yesterday, but his own delegate count remained no different than it was yesterday. With a smile, the liberal Republican claims he's just being conservative in his estimate.
Are they going to let you all into this program today?
Oh, yes, I hope so. How are you this morning?
Couldn't be better.
Optimistic?
Optimistic. Conservatively optimistic, as I put it the other day.
I thought you should be liberally optimistic.
No, it's in the spirit of it.
Following an interview on NBC's Meet the Press this morning, Rockefeller, perhaps for the 100th time, declared what he expects once the balloting is underway.
Constant slight erosion. My opinion on the second ballot, the erosion will start in a more determined way, but on the third ballot is where the big change will take place.
Governor, the Oklahoma delegation was released today with the suggestion that it go to Mr. Nixon. Is this significant to you, sir?
Well, I thought that he had it anyhow, to tell you the truth.
You don't feel in that case this would be included in Mr. Nixon's figure?
That's right. Already was.
Bob Douglas is Governor Rockefeller's national campaign manager. Bob, is the Reagan strategy still important to the Rockefeller strategy?
It certainly is at this moment in the convention, Mort. Reagan is doing very well in the southern states and in some of the western states, picking up delegate strength.
Delegate strength from Nixon, you believe?
That's right. And since Mr. Nixon is presently the front runner in terms of delegates, any erosion to uncommitted or to Governor Reagan, of course, helps our cause.
Now, there was a published report out of Washington that there's been the establishment of a
Reagan-Rockefeller hotline, a telephone link here between the two camps. Is that true?
Well, I don't know as I'd call it a hotline, but our two trailers at the convention do have a direct line from one to the other, and there might come a point during the balloting that we might have use for the telephone.
Well, what would you talk about now? Does this mean there is great consideration to this much-discussed Rockefeller-Reagan ticket?
Well, let's put it this way. Governor Reagan hasn't himself announced as a candidate, but I'm sure that if and when he becomes a candidate, his interest will be the same as ours, and that is that Mr. Nixon not get this nomination on the first or second ballot, because I think that's really the ball game.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. Rockefeller's design for victory not only relies on a healthy Ronald Reagan, but also, somewhat prayerfully, on the expectation that Ohio Governor James Rhodes will retain his favorite son status through two ballots and then swing to Rockefeller. The Ohio delegation caucuses tomorrow. Until then, the Rockefeller people should be sweaty with anticipation. Morton Dean, CBS News at Rockefeller headquarters.
The third of the three major candidates, Ronald Reagan, professes not to be a candidate at all. But he has a campaign organization, unofficial, of course. He has a campaign manager who calls himself a coordinator. And just as the others do, he does have a command post trailer out behind the hall here from which a staff will keep tabs on the balloting Wednesday night. He also has reporters following him around as if his denials don't mean a thing, and they don't. In our case, it is Bill Stout at Reagan headquarters at the Deauville Hotel. Bill?
In this curious campaign, the non-candidate candidacy of Ronald Reagan has brought him so far along that he now feels compelled to deny again and again that he would even consider the second spot on the ticket.
Well, anyway,
God bless all of you, and thank you. As I say, whatever happens.
Remember one thing, though. When it is all over, far more important than any individuals is the cause itself and the need for a change in philosophy in Washington. So we're all together and we're all on one side once it's over, no matter which way it goes. And then I will just make you one more... make you one more promise. There's one thing that I definitely am not a candidate for. I ain't about to be on anybody's ticket for vice president.
Later on the CBS broadcast, Face the Nation, Reagan made that denial even stronger in reply to a question.
Well, let me answer that in the context of whoever is asked. Once the decision is made and the party and the candidate approach an individual about taking that position, it is going to be, for that individual, very hard to say no. I'm quite sure that pressure will be put and that every argument will be used. But I have also made it very plain how I feel. And I am not interested at all. I believe that I can do more good as governor of California. I feel that I have made this pledge to the people of California with regard to that position, that I would not exchange the governorship for that.
That's a completely closed question. And
that
as far
is
as
a
you're
closed
concerned.
Question as far
if,
as
if it were offered, you would turn it down?
I would turn it down, yes.
It may be that Reagan is indeed protesting too much. Certainly there are a great many people here, politicians and reporters alike, who say that any man will accept the vice presidency. The most recent example, Lyndon Johnson, a proud and powerful man who went to the 1960 convention aiming for the White House. He fought and lost, and he took second place. Reagan, the argument goes, would do the same when and if the offer were made. But you hear none of that talk among the Reagan people themselves. They schedule their man for private meetings today with the members of half a dozen state delegations. And they say he's picked up a great many delegates in just the past 24 hours. They say his first ballot vote is now pushing 300. Enough, they believe, to deny a first ballot victory to Richard Nixon, enough so that the delegates will then turn to the man from California. Bill Stout, CBS News, at the California headquarters, Miami Beach.
The last of our candidate reports is from the headquarters least likely to succeed, although the candidate, Harold Stassen of Pennsylvania, has been running for the office longer than all the other major candidates combined. 20 years, as a matter of fact. John Hart reports from Stassen headquarters at the Seville Hotel.
What we have here is a rare thing. Youth without illusions. They are the Stassen youth.
I can't say that he's the greatest candidate in the world. He doesn't have the best shot at winning, but he doesn't have a really good chance, but he's got good ideas, and I think he should be backed. If a person who's got good ideas should be backed.
The Stassen youth know their candidate is an underdog in the race to become a dark horse. Still, they have been working for him here in Miami all week. Contrary to many clever people, they do not find him ridiculous.
I feel that as time goes along, he's going to be meeting personally with delegates, and this is his main strength, his personality. And given time, I believe he could build up strength. Now, maybe we might not have hopes of winning the nomination, but definitely at least swinging it to a man who at least closely follows Governor Stassen's ideals.
Stassen made his Miami arrival today. He was here earlier but went away so he could have his arrival today. His entire strategy for victory is pinned to a 9th or 10th ballot deadlock, a prospect considered remote by the average observer here. One Stassen aide said many delegates who like neither Nixon nor Rockefeller will find a place to park with Stassen. One of Stassen's problems at this convention is to find a parking place for himself. At the moment, he could not even get on the convention floor because the Arrangements Committee has ruled he is not yet a genuine candidate. To do that, he must show substantial strength in more than one state. He has refused to do so far, and therefore, at this moment, has not even any access to the floor. He may, at a news conference tomorrow, say where his hidden support is. Until he does, it can only be presumed he is protecting them from a raid by other candidates. John Hart, CBS News at Stassen headquarters.
Do you like the taste of mildness?
Why do you ask?
Try a Parliament. It's an American cigarette.
You get the most out of mildness with Parliament cigarettes.
Well?
The filter's recessed in a mouthpiece?
Well, what's your answer?
What was your question?
You get the most out of mildness with Parliament, so get the most.
Well, do you like the mouthpiece?
Weren't we talking about mildness?
You get the most out of mildness with
Parliament cigarettes. Harold Stassen, who we saw a moment ago, lost his one pledged vote tonight. The Ohio delegate who is going to vote for him has decided to switch to Ohio's favorite son, Governor John Rhodes. As for the rest of the numbers game, CBS News has canvassed the delegates, and with 667 votes needed to win, gives Richard Nixon 631 first ballot votes, an erosion of 13 votes since our Friday tabulation, and 36 short of nomination. Rockefeller, 244 votes, a loss of 8 since our last count. And Reagan, 154 votes, no change. Undetermined votes, which include favorite sons and undecided delegates, come to 304. So the CBS News delegate count puts Mr. Nixon, 36 votes, below the total necessary for nomination, but certainly within sight should one of those big uncommitted states, such as Michigan or Ohio, fall his way. They both caucus tomorrow morning, but Bill Plant, looking into the crucial question of the uncommitted, went to the Michigan delegation for this report.
At Michigan delegation headquarters, there are 48 delegates, uncommitted except to the favorite son candidacy of Governor George Romney. Romney, the first man into the presidential race this year, and the first one out, is the only one who holds the key to those 48 votes, at least for the first couple of ballots. The governor is holding forth in a top floor suite at the hotel. Governor Romney, what's the reason for maintaining an uncommitted delegation?
Well, there were two basic reasons. Number one was to have as much influence on the platform and the position of the candidates on the issues as possible before the convention. And number two, to have an open convention, because I think it's very much in the interest of the party and whoever we nominate to have an open convention.
How long do you think that you'll maintain this posture?
Well, this depends on developments here at the convention. Our delegation is going to meet Monday morning, take another look at the situation, and then we'll decide when we'll take another look, probably sometime during the balloting.
What is the bargaining power of the uncommitted delegation in more specific terms?
Well, of course, this depends upon the actual delegate count and how many committed delegates the different candidates have. I think at this point it's an open convention because I don't believe that any candidate has enough committed delegates on a firm basis to get the nomination. So under these circumstances, the uncommitted delegations are in a position to possibly have a balance of delegate votes.
Do you think it likely, Governor, that if you release your delegation and that if Mr. Nixon is doing very well on the first ballot, that many would go to him and, as it were, get on the bandwagon?
Oh, I think if the three governors, Governor Agnew, Governor Rhodes, and myself, released our delegates, that it may be that former Vice President Nixon would have enough votes to get the nomination. Now, on the other hand, we think it's very much in the interests of the party and Mr. Nixon, if he's finally the nominee, to have a convention where he really gets the nomination as a result of a real candidate contest and a careful consideration by the delegates.
Just one more question, Governor. Is there any possibility that you will do what you did in 1964, and that is hold delegates to yourself to the end, when only eight of your delegates went to Senator Goldwater and 40 stayed with you?
No, I don't see that prospect here.
Much, of course, will depend upon the timing of the release. If it comes before the first ballot, then most of the delegates will very likely go two-thirds for Rockefeller, one-third for Nixon. But if it comes during a first ballot Nixon sweep, most of the delegates will very likely choose to ride along with the winner. Bill Plant, CBS News at Michigan Delegation Headquarters, Miami Beach.
Uncommitted delegates are the subject of sometimes strange pressures to win their votes. And we have a report now from a special correspondent, an expert on this peculiar aspect of convention politics, Mr. Arthur Buchwald.
The most sought-after man at the Republican convention here in Miami, Florida, is the uncommitted delegate. It is he who will eventually decide the outcome of this exciting nominating contest, and the responsibility weighs heavy on his mind. This afternoon, I was fortunate to talk to an uncommitted delegate. I beg your pardon, sir. You know, being an uncommitted delegate is not all fun and games. There's a lot of hard work involved with it. Come on, make it snappy, fella. I'm in a hurry. Sir, what made you decide to become an uncommitted delegate?
Well, you know, if you're a committed delegate, nobody cares about you. Nobody cares what you do. But if you're an uncommitted delegate, everybody cares about you. Makes life very pleasant.
Could you give an example of how the candidates wooed the uncommitted delegates?
Well, when I first got to my room, there was a basket of fruit from Nelson Rockefeller. There was grapes and bananas and pears and dates. I love dates. And then there was an autographed picture of Ronald Reagan wrapped around a can of pistachio nuts. You know, I don't know how the Reagan people found out I love pistachio nuts. I was very touched.
What did the Nixon people send over?
They sent me an invitation to the Julie Nixon David Eisenhower wedding reception. And they don't throw those around. You know, I checked with the committed delegates to find out what were in their rooms. You know what was there? A sign. And it said if they don't check out by noon on Friday, they have to pay for another day.
You did right to come uncommitted. Tell me, sir, are you influenced by the polls that have come out during the last week?
Oh, nobody could help but be influenced by the polls. I know, for example, that Rockefeller can beat McCarthy and Humphrey. And I know that Nixon can beat Rockefeller. And I know that Reagan can beat Wallace. And I also know that Harold Stassen can beat Thomas Dewey. But what I don't know is if Lou Harris can beat George Gallup. And I'm not going to make up my mind until I find out when that poll's taken.
What will eventually make you decide which candidate you'll choose?
The issues. This election is far too important to be decided on emotion alone. Of course, I'm going to wait till the last day before I make up my mind. I don't blame you. Do you have any advice to other uncommitted delegates? Yes. My advice to all uncommitted delegates is, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the cabana.
As for public opinion posters, next week has got to be a better week than last week. Last week went this way, you may remember. On Monday, a Gallup poll reported that Richard Nixon would do better than Nelson Rockefeller running against either Hubert Humphrey or Eugene McCarthy in November. This seemed to explode Nelson Rockefeller's contention, on which he was basing his hopes here, that he alone could win in November as a Republican candidate. On Thursday, a Lewis Harris poll reported, however, Nelson Rockefeller would beat either McCarthy or Humphrey, but that Richard Nixon would lose to either one. Confusion and consternation about those conflicting polls were so strong that Harris and Gallup conferred and they issued a joint interpretation. It said, in effect, that their polls agreed that they really were not so far apart, that the differences were results of polling at different times and reporting at different times in what is, to say the least, a very fluid situation, as they put it. Also said the Harris-Gallup statement, if anyone examined the information in both polls jointly, it would show a growing trend toward Rockefeller. Well, predictably, on Friday, Congressman John Moss of California said the time has come for someone to step in and investigate, and in this case, it would be Congress. Yesterday, pollster Burns Roper chimed in to attribute the kind of accuracy to polls that is being implied, he said, and to attribute any great importance to a few points lead in view of the clear fluidity of public opinion at this time is ridiculous. So spoke Roper of Harris and Gallup. Undaunted, Lewis Harris issued another poll yesterday, and it reports that one out of four voters who said they would vote against Nixon and for Humphrey would shift away from Humphrey and vote for Rockefeller if that were the choice. We'll hear from Eric Severide and Roger Mudd in a moment.
The tabletop is made of a remarkable Masonite hardboard product called Benelux. Benelux, an industrial product so dense and tough, it's hard to believe it comes from wood. This characteristic density of Masonite hardboard protects your home, too, with Color Lock siding. Color Lock is pre-finished. So smooth and hard, it's virtually damage-proof. This year, Color Lock and other Masonite siding products will be protecting some 2 million American homes. This year, the choice is siding, made by Masonite Corporation, where our resource is timber, and our product is imagination.
In our analysis studio, that's right downstairs off the convention floor, Eric Severide and Roger Mudd will deliver themselves of remarks, of observations, and analysis this week. Tonight, Eric on Mr. Nixon, Roger on vice presidential candidates.
Richard Milhouse Nixon, the front runner in this Republican convention, shares the biological history of his party. 6 years ago, he was at the point of political death. 4 years ago, the whole party was. Today, he sees the nomination in the White House within his grasp. His party sees a possible majority in at least one chamber of the Congress, an increased majority of the state capitals. If Nixon is nominated after losing once and being passed over the next time around, then he will have done something no one else has ever done. This party owes its resurgence to the fresh new blood injected in the last 2 to 3 years and to the decline of the Democrats under Johnson. Nixon owes his own resurgence mostly to Richard Nixon. Consider. He has not won an election on his own in 18 years. He could not get elected governor of his own state. He had to abandon his Western identity and become an Easterner. He has no marked following among Negroes or labor or youth and only a partial hold on big business. His personality is not charismatic. He is scarcely a spellbinding orator. No smoke arises from the page of his written prose, and he dreams no exalting dreams. How then and why then? Because he has made himself Mr. Republican.
the obedient, reliable, serious Quaker boy, has become his party's man for all seasons, for rich or for poor, for war or for peace, for in or for out, until death do them part. Because he is highly intelligent and always learning. Because he is what Thomas Wolfe called the man of measured merriment, who restrains his laughter and his anger, and makes party friends by not making enemies. Because with him, politics is total immersion. All else in life is rather boring. And his dedication to the political vindication of Richard Nixon is single-minded, monolithic, all-encompassing. He has seen the speeding Republican hares flash by and fade out, the Scrantons, the Goldwaters, the Romneys. The tortoise plods on and on, and in this year of astonishments, the appealing old fable may yet come true. If it does, if Nixon is nominated, it will be in large part because this party, like this nation, is a political mosaic, and today the regional, ideological, and economic interests coexist in a state of extreme alienation. Only in temporary unity can Republicans win this fall. There's a deep instinct in this Miami gathering to find the unifier, the healer. At the moment, this man with the fewest party enemies seems prepared for that role. He may not excite, healers are not supposed to, but he comforts. Roger?
Time was when nobody wanted to be vice president. Daniel Webster refused in 1848, saying, "I don't propose to be buried until I am really dead and in my coffin." And Cactus Jack Garner in the Texas patois with which we are now more familiar snorted, "The vice presidency isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit." But since World War II, the vice presidency has become infinitely desirable, causing grown men to lie, grovel, and make public fools of themselves. No one comes to a convention openly seeking the vice presidency, however, for fear of losing it. But there are at least six men here in Miami Beach who could be persuaded. Charles Harting Percy, 48, of Illinois, earnest, intense, sometimes to the point of being sophomoric, publicity conscious, has been photographed here playing tennis, the drums, and water skiing. Acceptable to Rockefeller, cut from Nixon cloth. John Anthony Volpe, 59, of Massachusetts, hungers for the nomination. A big city Italian Catholic, defeated as a favorite son by a Rockefeller write-in, remains pledged to Nixon. Claims he could add 10% to the party's urban vote. John Vliet Lindsay, 47, of New York, a Republican Kennedy, the nation's lone truly charismatic politician, claims he will not accept. His nomination would send the party on the big city ethnic route, an intense rival of Nelson Rockefeller. Mark Odom Hatfield, 46, of Oregon, nominated Nixon in 60, keynoter in 64. A Vietnam dove who once sported a McCarthy button under his lapel now supports Nixon in order, he said, to reestablish communications, regarded as Nixon's choice. James Allen Rhodes, 58, of Ohio, the governor and favorite son, buckled under Goldwater pressure at the 64 convention, lacks a national reputation. Nixon and Rocky want his votes, but not him, a possible cabinet appointment. And Edward William Brooke, 48, of Massachusetts, a Republican showpiece, the convention's temporary chairman, has picked up steam in the Senate. Only Rocky would appear believable with him as a running mate. Nixon would risk a Southern revolt. There are others, Romney, Tower, Baker, Agnew, and Schaefer. But for Nixon or Rockefeller or Reagan to throw the convention open for the vice presidency involves more risks than advantages. It could overload the ticket to one side and further divide the party. The number two man will, in all probability, again be chosen by the nominee and the party's top leaders with an eye to regional and ideological balance. For the country's most second important job, that is probably the least democratic, but the soundest way of choosing. Walter?
There's also the chance, Roger, that those losing presidential candidates may turn into vice presidential candidates. A Kennedy-Johnson ticket, after all, was no more far-fetched at this time in 1960 than a Nixon-Rockefeller ticket would be this year, I would suppose. The other major business of the convention, of course, is the platform, a catalog of positions on which the Republican Party expects its candidate to face the electorate in November. It's hammered out in a combination of public and private meetings, which in this case began a week ago last Monday morning. Joe Bente has been following those sessions from the beginning, from convention headquarters at the Fontainebleau. Joe?
This is Senator Everett Dirksen's political baby for 1968, the Republican National Platform. When Dirksen began herding his 101 fellow platform committee members together last Thursday afternoon to bring forth this document, he said he wanted something that would be without wind, that would be easy to understand, easy to read, and easy to stand upon. He got some 10,000 words and about 33 pages and a share of problems. One of those was not solved until early today, and for a report on that, here's CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore.
Here in the Voltaire Room, behind tight security, the platform writer sat until after four this morning, ducking a head-on collision on Vietnam by an adroit compromise that's being called the Dirksen Unity Resolution. It was, in fact, mainly written by the Rockefeller forces with Nixon's support and scrapped large, hawkish sections of the original draft. Veering between hard and soft liners, it pledges a program of peace, but neither peace at any price nor a camouflaged surrender. It supports negotiations as long as they offer any reasonable prospect for a just peace. It calls for progressive de-Americanization of the war, but avoids any reference to a pullout. And in one section retained from the original draft, it condemns what it calls the administration's breach of faith with the American people, respecting our heavy involvement in Vietnam, but does not criticize that involvement. This satisfied the 100 weary platform writers enough to give unanimous approval. But Senator Jacob Javits, who lost his one-man fight for amendments on talking to the Viet Cong and phasing out American troops, he abstained. He says, however, he can live with the resolution. It is the hawks among the Reagan supporters who may have trouble swallowing it, for their ideas of escalation for victory are not reflected in this moderate resolution.
Vietnam is only one issue where the platform tends to blur the areas of controversy. In what might be called the Republican platform's law and order section, the document states flatly that in trying to achieve fundamental social change, the Republicans will not tolerate violence. And almost as an echo of the sentiments which were expressed here last Wednesday by California Governor Ronald Reagan, the platform claims that men are accountable for what they do, that criminals are responsible for their crimes, and that while a youth's environment may help explain a man's crime, it does not excuse that crime. While pledging to attack social injustice in every form, the platform does little to identify where it believes such injustices exist and precisely how they should be attacked. The Republicans pledge a determined effort to rebuild and enhance public respect for the Supreme Court and all other courts. Such a statement, without spelling out what is meant by the implied loss of the respect of this court, apparently will satisfy many who blame today's rising crime rates on decisions made by the Supreme Court. In some of the other areas, the Republican platform calls for revision but not an end to the Selective Service system, promising to put it on a standby basis if that's possible and attempt to raise a volunteer army. It proposes a job opportunity data bank which would match the jobless with unfilled jobs across the nation. A unified federal food distribution program, but no mention of those counties which now do not make use of existing federal food programs. And it attacks the Johnson administration for not making use of court-sanctioned wiretapping to fight crime, pledging that if the Republicans get into office, they will use such devices. There are many more items and quite a bit of the familiar rhetoric of platforms, all of which should not be read now, but should be saved for Senator Everett Dirksen, who will officially bring the platform to the nation Tuesday night. Joseph Benty, CBS News, at the Republican National Headquarters, Miami Beach.
If you like to get your money's worth, if you like to get your money's worth, you'll like the Goodyear Polyglass tire. The tire that gives up to double the mileage at nowhere near double the price. The tire with a polyester cord body and a fiberglass cord belt. The Polyglass tire keeps the wide tread firm, so it squirms less, wears less. Gives up to double the mileage of today's best-selling Goodyear tires at nowhere near double the price. Get up to double the mileage with the Polyglass tire. Only Goodyear has it.
Well, the focus of attention this week will, of course, be on the floor inside this convention hall.
There may be action on the streets around this hall, too. A number of groups dissatisfied by what the Republicans will and won't do this week have announced their intentions of demonstrating around Convention Hall. CBS News correspondent Bert Quint has taken a look at who they are and what's being done to control them.
It looks as though it's going to be peaceful outside of Convention Hall. There are several demonstrations planned, but they don't shape up, not yet at least, as the kind that can turn suddenly into riots. Just the same, law officers are taking no chances. A conservative estimate puts the number of federal, state, and local police at more than 1,000, and this is for a place that is relatively easy to isolate. Miami Beach is an island, reachable by road only over causeways that can be blocked quickly. It doesn't seem, as of now, that there will be need for that, though. The groups that have announced their intention to gather outside the hall are not particularly menacing. One is the National Council of Senior Citizens, which represents a tenth of the country's elderly people. Miami Beach has the largest percentage of people over 55 in the United States. Many of them, men and women who band together in their loneliness and limited means, plan to stroll. For them, a militant march would be a bit difficult. To Convention Hall Tuesday night to protest against what they say is the Republican Party's traditional lack of interest in them. William Hutton is the council's executive director.
Since 1935, when the Republican Party unfortunately had strong opposition to Social Security, and in 1965, when they had strong opposition to Medicare, there has unfortunately been a sad record in far of the problems of older people in the Republican Party are concerned. Now, the National Council of Senior Citizens, which is a nonpartisan organization, does have many clubs here, and we're, while nonpartisan, are very, very much interested in politics. They want to increase Social Security. They want to improve Medicare. And so they want to tell the delegates, and they're going to have a senior citizens stroll and a rally on Tuesday night here in Miami.
If the Republicans are accused of being disinterested in the senior citizens, they, or at least one of them, has taken pains to show an interest in another group, the ghetto Negroes. Senator Charles Percy visited a Miami neighborhood to chat with some of them, to sit in at the drums with a few youngsters, and quite obviously, inasmuch as the trip took only about an hour and the news media were carefully advised about it, to pick up a little publicity. The Negroes want more than this from the Republicans. One of their leaders, Dr. Ralph David Abernathy, says he intends to bring his Poor People's Campaign to Miami to demonstrate. And another group, the National Council of Concerned Afro-American Republicans, has filed suit to try to stop the Florida and Louisiana delegations, from which it says Negroes have been deliberately excluded, from taking part in the convention. The council's Florida leader, Isaac Williams, told CBS News reporter Hal Walker of his plans.
We have gotten Bill Land from New York City to come in Monday to coordinate mass demonstrations and mass picketing against the little white makeup of the Republican convention.
How many people do you think will take part in this mass demonstration?
We have already over 200 people ready to participate with us if necessary.
Where will the demonstrations take place?
Initially, we shall begin with the convention site, the Fountain Blue, which houses the National Committee, and the Doral Country Club, which houses the Florida delegation.
There are about 200,000 Cubans in the Miami area, and a good many of them are unhappy about what they say is U.S. coexistence with Fidel Castro. They resent the fact that the United States prevents exiles from launching raids on Cuba from these shores. Jose Borrell, a spokesman for an organization called Free and Independent Cuba, explains why the Cubans plan to demonstrate.
We're going to have at least 1,000 women, the widows, the mothers, the sisters, the sweethearts of all the boys that have been assassinated by communist Cuba, Fidel Castro, and the infamous firing squad walls. And that will be a sort of a religious ceremony. All the ladies will be in black. And then in Miami Stadium, we're going to have a big rally, which will be probably 20 or 25,000 people. Just to that, to tell the United States there's absolutely no reason of coexistence. We will not allow Cuba to be sold out.
Police will let groups of up to 1,000 gather near the convention hall. but they put up a fence to make sure they don't get too near. If there is any nervousness now, though, it's not so much because of the scheduled demonstrations. It's the unexpected that can cause difficulties. A lone man, perhaps, with a hidden gun, or a group of agitators who would rather make trouble than merely make their voices heard. As for these eventualities, security officers can only hope that they don't come and plan to move quickly if they do. Bert Quint, CBS News, Miami Beach.
Conventions, this one included, are not all business, of course. At the Grand Ballroom of the Fontainebleau Hotel tonight, right now, a party at $500 a head to raise campaign funds. And Hughes Rudd is there.
The Republicans are throwing a real bash tonight, and it should be, since it costs some $500 a head. The party expects to raise over $1 million with this dinner dance tonight, and they're so determined that everybody have a good time that they're keeping all cameras and reporters out of the dining room and the bar for fear that it might inhibit the gaiety. During the cocktail hour, a Calypso steel band from Trinidad played in the bar, but our cameras were kept out. Senator George Murphy, who's in charge of the entertainment tonight, says the band can even play Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata on 50-gallon oil drums. After the cocktail hour, the $500 guests streamed over to the Grand Ballroom, which the hotel says is the biggest in the country, where they were confronted by a whole orange grove. 200 orange trees were uprooted and trucked over here, set in place around the room, and then volunteers hung real oranges on the real trees with little hooks like you use on Christmas tree ornaments. The oranges had been picked earlier, frozen, and then thawed for tonight for some reason, and a lot of them looked pretty green. An unexpected pastoral note in all this was the fact that the crickets which lived in the trees in the orange grove are still living in them. And you can hear them when Lester Lannon's band isn't playing.
Watch the cable.
The menu had a pretty high orange content, too, with fresh oranges at the beginning and orange sherbet packed into scooped-out oranges at the end. In between, there was breast of capon, artichoke bottoms with asparagus tips, baby carrots, a combination of wild rice and saffron rice, which the hotel calls continental rice, and a salad made out of hearts of palm. The wine was white, a Pinot Chardonnay from California. All in all, it didn't sound much like those Democratic blowouts, which in recent years at least have run pretty heavily to chili and barbecued spare ribs, washed down with bourbon and branch. The young Republicans also had a party tonight in the La Ronde Room, with admission only $5. For that, they got no drinks or any food, but they did get a rock band called the 31st of February, which played anti-Vietnam War songs and civil rights songs. One anti-war song is called the Fixin' to Die Rag, but it didn't seem to upset anybody. After all, young Republicans can officially remain young Republicans until they're 40. As one of them says, we're not a bunch of teeny boppers. There was also a satiric review put on by the Dade County Young Republicans in which they impersonated the Supreme Court and sang a song which went, "We are the highest court, we are the last resort. Of this there is no doubt, we throw the Constitution out." Now, this piano played no part in the entertainment tonight, partly because the lid to the keyboard is nailed down. So far, nobody has accused any Nixon supporters of having done it, but they have claimed to have nailed down just about everything else in town.
I'll be back with some final thoughts on what's going to happen at this, the 29th Republican National Convention, in a moment.
We're thinking about introducing Benson & Hedges 100s around the world. After all, we've had the disadvantages to ourselves long enough. Cigarette that made Extra Puffs popular in America, make Extra Puffs popular around the world.
So tomorrow is the opening day of the Republican National Convention here in Miami Beach. The stage is set. The actors have been milling around on it with the curtain up for the last several days.
CBS News convention coverage will begin tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. with Joseph Benty in the morning news, and we'll be here at the anchor booth beginning at 7:30. That's rather early, but if we can make it, we expect you here. Attendance will be taken. The first session will convene here at Convention Hall at 10 a.m. At that time, Mayor Dermer of Miami Beach, Republican Congressman J. Herbert Burke, Governor Claude Kirk of Florida, all will welcome to Florida the delegates, most of whom already have been here for several days, presumably officially unwelcomed. The one thing certain about tomorrow is that nothing of any great political significance will take place, tomorrow morning at any rate. Political conventions are, as a matter of fact, very conventional, we found. There is a form they all hold to, certain procedures that they're going to go through come hell or high water. The convention hall is booked. The hotel rooms are paid for through Thursday now. The clergymen of different faiths are carefully scheduled for separate but equal time. Yes, there is a form, you see. Some of the conventions of conventions seem like a waste of time. It's hard to keep in mind that the decisions made here, sometimes for what seem to be whimsical or even self-serving reasons, can influence the lives of us all. The conventions, however they may look in detail, are not a waste of time. They are not a silly political exercise. They are a part of our system. As almost everyone has said, it isn't good, but no one has come up with a better system yet. If it is certain that nothing important will take place tomorrow morning, it is equally certain that, like any political convention, it will hold a great deal of fascination for those concerned and interested citizens of this nation. That should include us all. It doesn't seem right that something so important should be so much fun as a national political convention. We hope you'll watch it with us. This is Walter.
Tonight, as election fever grips the land, this network brings you face-to-face the candidates who have everybody talking. The Enco Tiger and the Enco Advertising Manager. First, the Advertising Manager.
Tonight, I'm going to give you only the fascinating facts. Fact one, Enco Extra Gasoline has unsurpassed aspiration system detergency to keep your carburetor and your intake manifold factory clean. Fact two, Enco Extra is the only gasoline made that will give you more
happy motoring.
Fact 77, Enco Extra Gasoline is unexcelled in its anti-corrosion protection. I rest my case on facts.
And now let's hear from the Tiger. You mean you agree with the advertising manager? Well, have you anything to say?
Like he said, put a tiger in your tank.
This has been a CBS News Campaign 68 Convention Special Report. What's going to happen at Miami Beach? Brought to you by Humble Oil and Refining Company and their committee to save the tiger. This is CBS.